coming up on Garden Talk.
Because it's much better for a plant to have slightly less nutrients and work your way up than to basically force your plant to a nutrient lockout through that osmotic process and then have to reel it back in. There's these EC fans coming out right now, which basically can operate with digital controls, which can make them work a lot better with controllers, and they operate on way less wattage. Especially in the summer, I'm always adding CO2. And people are like, oh, what kind of crazy CO2 operation you got going in there? And I'm like, dude, it's a 4x4 tent. Just get an exhale bag or two. Hang it up. You'll be fine. So if there are any home growers out there who are like, you know what? I love doing this. I want to do this for a living. I want to make a career out of it. Start reading manuals on a lot of the technology. Watch a whole bunch of videos and read some manuals on how they work. And you're basically halfway there.
What's up, everybody? If you that don't know me, my name is Chris, aka Mr. Grout, and you're tuned into the Garden Talk podcast. This is episode number 17. In this episode, I interview Nate Lipton. Nate is the owner of GrowHisHouse.com, which is one of the largest grow equipment suppliers in the U.S. He is also the host of Canna Cribs, a show where they tour various cultivation facilities. Nate grows plants in both a small greenhouse located in his backyard, as well as an indoor grow tent. He grows a wide variety of plants, such as leafy greens, melons, broccoli, cauliflower, medicinal, herbs, and so much more. And we talk about a wide variety of topics in this video, from nutrients to auto-watering to feeding charts to LED grow light tests and a new product that's coming onto the market soon. If you're tuned in on YouTube, there are chapters set so you can easily navigate to different topics. Subscribe to the channel if you haven't already and click that thumbs up button. If you're listening to this podcast on one of the podcast platforms, please leave a rating and review. And if you're liking these episodes and you want to support the podcast even more, you can do that through Patreon. The link to that is patreon.com/MrGrowIt. I'll leave a link to it down in the description section below. Before we get into the episode, I'd like to give a shout out to our sponsor for this episode, Dutch Pro Nutrients. Dutch Pro is a plant fertilizer company that was established in Amsterdam back in the early 90s. And as of a few years ago, their products are now available here in the USA. They have base nutrients, additives, pH regulators, really anything needed for proper plant nutrition. Dutch Pro is now officially a long-term sponsor of the podcast, so you'll be hearing their name a lot. I'll leave a link to their Amazon store down in the description section below. And you can use code MrGrowIt10DP for a discount on their products. All right, now let's get into the episode. All right, here we are. Nate from Grower's House. How are you doing today?
Dude, I'm doing pretty well, Chris. How about you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for joining me. So we've known each other for a little while now, right? We met in MJ BizCon. What was it, 2017 or something like that?
Yeah, about that. I don't know. When you go to MJ BizCon for like so many years in a row, they all just kind of like do this. So,
and then we linked up recently while you were in Vegas. You were doing a whole bunch of episodes of your show, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about. And yeah, man, it's good to be able to sit down and do this talk with you. We'll learn a little bit more about your garden, and then we're going to go over some additional questions that we have for you today. So you ready to get going?
Yeah, I'm ready to get going. And what the viewers and listeners should know is that Chris and I had an amazing Chinese dinner in Las Vegas when we were there, and we had like three lobsters and a table full of plates, and it was an awesome night.
It was incredible. Yeah, for sure. So for those that don't know who you are, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of how you got into gardening?
Yeah. So, a little bit about myself right now. I'm the co-CEO of, a group of companies, the largest one being Grower's House, which is an equipment supplier both to hobbyists and commercial growers. So like 16,000 products, everything you'd carry from like irrigation to lighting to rolling benches, hydroponic systems, so nutrients, stuff like that. But then we also do have some YouTube channels and a forum. So we have Growers Network and then, the YouTube channel that we'll chat about a little bit later, which people can check out. And let's see, other than that, how I got started, I guess, is just being one of those curious kids in college who starts growing. And next thing you know, you're like, which way should I go in my life? And I was like, maybe I'll go into something related to finance or something like that. But it turns out my internship told me that that was not the right choice. And I decided to go down this path. And I've been doing it for, it's like 13, 14 years at this point. I've been in the hydro and like growing industry.
Crazy. Yeah, I'm looking at your YouTube channel, the Growers House YouTube channel right now. And I'll link this down in the YouTube description section below so you guys mm-hmm. can go to that. But if you sort by oldest to newest, you've got videos from like 8 years ago, and you see you got a different hairstyle back then, huh?
Yeah, I had a different everything style back then, especially shooting style. But yeah, we have those two channels that probably will be in the description below. But yeah, don't look at the ones from 8 years ago. Definitely look at the ones that are like in the last year. That's probably better. Those ones are antiquated, you know.
Yeah, but it looks like your channel is mostly about like equipment, different equipment that you have. You know, I assume you sell this all at Grower's House. Mm-hmm. And you said you wanted to talk about light testing, which we'll get to towards the end of this episode.
So. Yeah, sounds great.
So cool. Let's talk about the garden. So you have a garden, right? I don't know if you grow, do you grow indoors or outdoors, and what type of plants do you grow?
Yeah, so right now people do ask me that question a lot. They're like, so what are you doing? You're growing like a humongous outdoor plot or a greenhouse or like a 50,000 square foot indoor? And I'm like, well, you know, not really. I kind of have a little setup at home, both a kind of what I would consider a really small greenhouse, almost like a hoop house. That's where mainly the veggies grow that we play around, me and my girlfriend. And then we do have the indoor grow tent, where I do a little like R&D, research and development on like new products coming out. You know, we do resell other products, but we have a lot of our own product lines. We have our own grow tents, you know, our own carbon filters, fans, we've had our own line of LEDs. So when those products come in, I like to test them out and see if they work well. If they do, awesome. If they don't, we make some tweaks. Or sometimes we find, you know, a new partner to partner with. But that 4x4 for medicinal plants that's inside is, you know, it's relatively basic grow tent. And lately, you know, I tell people, man, my day job is like, it takes a lot of time. Like I'm usually working 6 or 7 days a week on the business, the equipment side. So we're helping other people grow. And when you do that, you realize you barely have any time for yourself to grow sometimes. So what we try and do is, you know, maybe we'll start with the veggie garden and we can move to the medicinal garden. But on the veggie garden, it's like, you know, 4 foot by 8 foot kind of hoop house thing growing. Like some days you just wake up on a Saturday and you're like, you know what? I'm going to go get some plants. You hit up the nursery in the morning, grab a coffee on your way out. Like that is like those mornings that I dream about. Then you just go pick some things. So most recently we got some broccoli, some cauliflower. You know, my girlfriend was all about getting an herb garden, kind of the traditional thing. So like oregano, rosemary, thyme, things of that sort, parsley. And then we tried some funkier things. You know, we tried some yams out there too. And we did try some melons, which it's funny. I think we got these seeds and we thought they were melons and they turned out to not be melons. So, you know, that's always a fun surprise too. But in Arizona, it's tough. Like you basically grow October through maybe May. Then in the summer, you just shut the outdoor one down. It gets way too hot. In Tucson, it'll be 100. You can get up to 110. And in that greenhouse, it'd be like 150 probably. You know, it's just everything would bake. But when you go into the medicinal garden, you know, like I said, working 6 or 7 days a week, I really want to set it up to just be fully automated in a way. So what I like to say is, you know, I want someone out there to write a book. Please, viewers, write this book. I would read it if someone had it. But, you know, how to grow medicinal plants for the busy person. And I will give you the outline of how to do it. So let's see. Get a 4x4 tent. Step one. Step two, I got an AutoPot 4Sight system. So some of you guys have probably heard about that. The good thing about it is you don't have to plug it into anything. It's totally gravity fed. Waters the plants as they need water. So with four plants and a 4x4, you know, on the medicinal side, you could yield, you know, with a good light, you could probably end up yielding, you know, about a pound. And, you know, what I would say is I could fill up that reservoir and about 2 weeks later I can come back and I would not have opened the tent for 2 weeks. I just filled the reservoir with nutrients, which is about 12 gallons-ish. So it depends on how big your plants are, how fast they're feeding. But then you just have a few timers, you know, for your lights to go on and off at the right times, for your ventilation to go on and off at the right times. And it's a super set it and forget it system. I loved it. And like in those buckets, you can choose what media you go with. And what I'd probably recommend most is filling these Autopop buckets. I think they're about 4 gallons each, and they gravity kind of feed, and then they will wick up through the media. And I'd fill it probably the first inch or two with hydroton, so clay pebbles. And then on top of that, you can kind of add whatever media you want. So I go with cocoa, straight cocoa. And, you know, you can use a lot of different cocos. Ones I would recommend is like, you know, Canada cocoa is great. Even Mother Earth cocoa is great. You can go Mother Earth straight cocoa with perlite. You know, some people even go into soilless mixes, like a Pro Mix. Those would also work really well. But the cool thing is you can even put like a nutrient dense soil above those clay pebbles, and it works really well in that system. And then you can like rely a little bit less on nutrients if you want, because, you know, with the cocoa, you definitely want to make sure the plants have that full nutrition in that reservoir. But you could do like an ocean forest inside of that, or a vermifier, which are two soils that come packed with enough nutrients that like 3 or 4 weeks in, you know, you can be totally fine, and then add some light nutrients thereafter. So pretty good system. I like it quite a bit. That's kind of my R&D system, because usually I'm testing out like lighting is very common, and then different forms of environmental control, but I leave the hydroponic system relatively the same.
Let's talk a little bit more about auto watering. So I have the auto pot system too. Yeah. I think I had like the 6 pot or whatever, and I think I used like 4, and then 2 of the plants ended up being male, so I went down to 2.
Yeah, that happens.
But it's so easy to use, like you said, it's gravity fed. I was actually, I did perlite on the bottom 2 inches. Then I used Fox Farm Ocean Forest soil, like you had suggested, or you talked about. And then I was actually top dressing with organic nutrients, and then my reservoir was only plain water. So it made things pretty simple. Now, this last run, I did have a little bit of issues because that top layer does kind of dry out a little bit. And when you're using organic nutrients in your top dressing, that top layer should be moist. So I need to figure out a way around that, whether it be a thicker mulch layer on top of it or what. But yeah, I mean, using that auto watering system was definitely made things a lot easier. So you're putting nutrients within that reservoir, right? What brand of nutrients are you using? And are you using any sort of like pump or air stones or anything to like mix it up, so the nutrients stay in solution, they don't just settle at the bottom or what?
Yeah. So let me actually, right before we jump into that, I'm going to give you a couple suggestions on your side. So when you order Autopots, you get this, what you've probably seen, it's almost like a mesh piece of fabric that you put on the bottom that keeps particulates from getting into and clogging some of the drains.
The copper disc.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you can actually use things like, think of it this way, water can permeate basically any type of fabric, right? You can make another layer of that. And what I would do is put the perlite, if you want to, you can add another layer of like, even think of it like this way, like a cheesecloth, right? And then you put maybe an inch or two of your ocean forest on, dress some of the nutrients in your top dressing, which you'd actually do a bottom dressing, add a layer of soil, dress a little bit more. And that way, as it wicks up, it'll pull the nutrients up with it, so it's not missing them because it's not wicking at the top. So that's one thing you could do in the future that might be helpful for that organic style, because that's really cool too. If people want to go organic but also have a hydro system, that's a good way to do it, like you were just talking about.
I tried to do it that way, and so sort of create a super soil to where it would be more dense in nutrients. So I added more nutrients on top of the Fox Farm and then more nutrients in to try to get it to last the entire grow. Now, those auto pot systems, I'm not sure if they're different pot sizes, but they're about 4 liters, I believe, is the pot size, just under 4 liter pot size. And it just, I guess maybe I grew vegetable plants for too long or what, but within flower, I started seeing those deficiencies, and that's why I didn't have that super soil. I didn't have enough nutrients in there. So maybe I just need to go heavier on the nutrients in the future. I think that would be a good idea for sure.
Yeah. Potentially, you know, that could be a way to do it, but I do think they're four gallons, not 4 liters, as a heads up.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. 4 gallons.
Yes. Yeah, so they're, and that's, they do have like an XL one, which I forgot. I think it's like 6 gallons or something, but it's a little bit bigger. I haven't used those. I just kind of go with the standard auto pots, but they're modular. So it's like, look, you have one plant that's just absolutely crushing it, and then you have another male, just take out the other pot. Super easy, you know. But going into, I guess in the latest R&D run that I was doing, nutrient-wise, I was running this new nutrient line that we're actually participating in bringing to market, which is called Ventana Plant Science. And, it's been about 2 years in development. And, most nutrients, I will say, they're based on a lot of the same kind of macro and micronutrients that plants need. So macros, being your NPK, and then micros being a lot of those kind of smaller elements that people don't hear about as much, your boron, your zinc, things like that. But the interesting thing about this one is there's a kind of like this proprietary amino acid polymer that we've been playing around with that this formulation chemist built, which has been pretty awesome because it was like supposed to be like it should and could be patented. But as soon as you patent kind of like a formula for a nutrient, basically, or anything like that, you release more information about how it's made. And like that is something. So that's why we call basically a proprietary instead of patented. So you want to keep some of the secret sauce, kind of so that we can keep the secret sauce the secret sauce. But the cool thing is we're going to be, selling it under the Ventana Plant Science name. And the interesting thing is this polymer, this amino acid polymer, it's actually made from the shells of mollusks. So like sea creatures, the shells of mollusks have this very interesting amino acid, and then they polymerized it, meaning that they made it in a way that's just hyper absorbable for plants. And it also breaks down other nutrients to be more absorbable by the plant. So George, the formulation chemist, this guy's been, we met him and he's the one who developed this. And we were like, man, this is the smartest person on plant nutrients we've ever met. And that's, me and one of our other people on our staff, Renee, who's been, she was the director of sales director for Botanicare for like a decade. And so she knows her nutrients really well. And, I love talking with her about nutrients. And she's written like a lot of the labels, for the old school labels that people have seen for Botanicare. But man, George is one of those guys that like, you just want to like crack open a beer and sit and just listen to him talk for like an hour, and he's just such a nice guy. But he developed it. They've been trying it out in a commercial garden. There were, a few of them for the last 2 years and with having some pretty good results. So I was trying it here and the plants grew amazingly. And that's the last R&D kind of thing that we were doing. But it's kind of like a pretty standard nutrient line when it comes to the amount of bottles. It's not advanced nutrients with 18. I think it's like a 6-bottle kind of formula. And then, proprietary amino acids in a product called Flava. It's like FLAVUH. Yep. So the best way I can compare it almost is like if you had like, what are people familiar with? Almost like a Terpinator meets Bud Candy in a way. So that's some effects you can see something like that.
Those 6 bottles, those aren't all base nutrients, right? Is it base nutrients plus their additives?
Exactly. Yep. Okay. Base nutrients plus the additives. So there's a kind of more of like a home gardener line and then there's a commercial line. But, they're basically the same thing. It's just the commercial line's more it's like a soluble powder because that's how most commercial gardens use their nutrients. A lot easier to transport, store. It can be a little bit cheaper when you're buying in bulk, like a pallet of nutrients. But it's basically a grow and a bloom. And then there's a CalMag, and there's a silica, and then there's the Flava, and then there's a PK, and that's basically the whole line. Yeah.
All powdered?
So, no, the at-home one is all liquids.
Okay.
And then the commercial line is all powder except for the Flava product, because that one has to be in a solution for it to that proprietary amino acid polymer to, like, work properly. So that's the only liquid. Yeah.
Okay. And then you said these are going to be released soon. I assume that the way folks can find out when they're released is probably to sign up to your email list. Is that right? The Grow's House email list.
Of course.
That you guys will make some sort of announcement or something and
let
those folks know that it's available or what?
Yeah, maybe we should like help her, you know, hire you for our marketing department or something. a lot of times we're like, it's funny we operate this way, but when it comes down to it, like we're growers and we're not like, I like to say we're a company of growers, but that comes with its pluses and minuses. What that means is we're not experienced at launching product lines. So we just like to R&D the products as much as possible, make sure that we're making something that like we love, it's doing like as good as it possibly can, and we stand behind and we'd recommend to our friends. And then we have to figure out how to get the message out there. So that's the part we're probably not as good at. We're probably good at growing the plants. The marketing side, yeah, we could probably use some help. So any marketers out there want to work with us, that'd be great. But yeah, fill out the email list.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, I'm not good at marketing either. So many people comment on my videos and like, you should be promoting your book more and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, I never like think about that stuff. Like I'm thinking about the garden and like showing off the plants and talking about the plants.
Yeah.
But
so it happens. You get
but yeah, I could use a marketer too. So anybody who's in marketing, hit me up.
Yeah, we can share them. You can work for both of us. It'd be a fun time.
That would be awesome. That'd be awesome. But getting back into the grow, let's talk about water source. So are you using RO water, tap water, rainwater? What are you doing for water?
Yeah, RO water for sure. Like I told you, the way I grow, when I'm doing R&D, I will say like, I do love, you know, fully organics. Like sometimes you feel like my garden outside with all the veggies, totally organic, right? 100%. And sometimes you're like, yeah, I really want the garden to just be all full of these meals and, you know, manures and basically everything that you feel like is just coming out of the earth and putting it back into it. You know, we have a compost bin, so I compost. And when it comes to the R&D side, though, on the medicinal plants and the grow tent, I like to have it a lot more dialed in a way where I'm the scientist controlling all the levers, right? So when I was talking about the clay pebbles and just straight cocoa core, totally inert, right? Add the nutrients in, and that's the way that, you know, basically I like to operate, and I want my water for those nutrients to be basically as close to zero parts per million as possible. So through an RO system, if as long as it's working properly, you're going to be between like 0 and 30 parts per million. If you're like north of, you know, you can see your membranes starting to go out when you're like kind of north of 50, but it's not too bad. Even up to 100, it's like, look, your water's still great. Once you get over 100, it's probably make sure you're checking your filters and everything like that.
I actually had a filter go out on me and I didn't realize it.
Ooh.
And I was growing with it and my plants started to look like hot trash.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Then I checked the PPM on my RO and it was like higher than tap. And I was like, okay, well, there we go. I think I had to change out the membrane or something like that. So that's a huge tip right there, is make sure you're checking the PPMs on your RO water, because you could, a filter could just go, or the membrane could go, and it could just be injecting tap water in there.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I don't, depending on how you do it, like sometimes I put like a, almost like those like $20 or $30 Rubbermaids you can put like in a garage or something, where you can have an RO filtering into it with a float valve, so it automatically shuts off when it fills. And then if you have like 30 or 40 gallons of water, I mean, I guess depending how large your grow is, but if you're just doing a home grow, that'll last you a while. So if you just test that out once every few weeks, you know, you should be good. But I notice people who like fill up their reservoir consistently with an RO system, you are, you know, I guess you'd be more prone to having issues, because you'd have to be testing basically every time RO is putting water in your reservoir or in your plants, which could be every day for some people, depending on how their system's set up.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, for the nutrients, you know, you mentioned you're in cocoa, inert medium, you're adding the nutrients. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this isn't a synthetic line that you're, that you've got, and that's so salt-based, and that, are you following a feeding chart? And this feeding chart that you guys have, is it for medicinal plants? Is it going to be a full dose is accurate for medicinal plants, or should it be like every other nutrient line, almost every other nutrient line, where it's typically recommended to start with a half dose and see how your plants are?
Yeah, and you know, it's so there is a feed chart both in milliliters per gallon and ppm for it. So both those are available on, you know, the URL for the site's actually ventanaplant.science. So it's not ventanaplantscience.com. But if you go there, you will see the two different feed charts. But you know, the funny thing is with nutrient lines, yeah, almost all of them kind of overstate, yeah, basically the concentration of nutrients you should give to your plants. And I do always really recommend going at half strength. And even for this one, I would start going at half strength and then work your way up, because it's much better for a plant to have slightly less nutrients and work your way up than to basically force your plant into a nutrient lockout through that osmotic process and then have to reel it back in. So that's honestly one of the reasons why a lot of people recommend that, and people, they usually have a better experience with nutrients when they go that way. And the interesting thing is, you know, some plants will do, they will look 100% healthy under half strength. And even if you start pushing it to three quarter strength and even up almost to full strength, some plants you won't even notice a difference. And they're just, you know, they're really adaptable to nutrient concentrations, you know, some strains, some plants, some cultivars, but some are not, and you have to find the sweet spot. So I wish there was like a general kind of rule or guideline I could give to people where I'd say, you know, here it is, just do this, close your eyes, walk away, and everything will be fine. But it's just not that easy, you know? So I think people, if you think of it this way, psychologically, if you have, by the way, just going back to that last point, if you are feeding half and your plant is looking great, and then you go up to whole, you know, 100%, and it's also still looking great, you probably just want to go back to half anyways, because at that point you're just kind of wasting nutrients. Like money, you know, and your plant's probably going to do just fine. It'll adapt to what it needs. But psychologically, if there was a nutrient line who said you should feed, you know, 5 mils a gallon, and then your plant is looking yellow at 5 mils a gallon in some ways that show a deficiency, and then you increase it to 10 mils a gallon, you know, sometimes people are psychologically are like, wow, you know, I'm feeding this plant so much. I'm so far above. It's almost like taking medicine. Like, do you want to take double the dose of a medicine? Do you think that's healthy or safe? So psychologically, it's better to tell people the limits over here than rather to underestimate the limit. And hopefully, depending on the cultivars you're growing, you know, someone is somewhere between that 75 to 100% range of what you give them. And I think psychologically, that's a little bit better for people to absorb if you have to throw something out there.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, with these lines, another thing you had mentioned that it could be, you know, overfeeding or toxicity issue or plant problems in general, maybe yellowing or whatever. Do you monitor the pH? You know, PPM is another thing, or EC is another thing that people look at. Do you personally do that? Do you recommend that for this nutrient line? Or there's some nutrient lines that have the pH perfect. Advanced has a pH perfect, so you don't need to worry about pHing your nutrient mix prior to giving your plant. So,
Yeah.
talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. And normally I would, if we're talking about nutrients in general, I do recommend pHing, but of course, mix your nutrients first, you know, wait 5 or 10 minutes, stir it up, test your nutrients out. For Advanced Nutrients pH Perfect, you know, that is an interesting product and it does work pretty well. This nutrient line as developed, if you add it to clean RO water and you add all the nutrients during every phase, like it should actually be in the correct pH so you won't have to pH it. So that is pretty cool. It's basically how the nutrient was designed, basically with George's, this comes back to George's genius of like basically what type of chemical structure am I going to have in each bottle and how is that going to make it so that it makes it as easy as possible. So this is, I guess you could call it, I don't know, I don't want to use that terminology, it might trademarked by Advanced Nutrients, but it is a pH balanced nutrient, so you don't have to jump in there. And the interesting thing is the way it's designed, the pH will fluctuate a little bit, but as it basically goes to the plant, it makes sure that the pH in the environment is proper for the nutrients to be absorbed, which is the most important part. So does that mean that your solution always has to be exactly at 6.2 pH? No, you know. It can vary a little bit, but people don't have to jump in there unless their, RO water they're starting with is at like a 4 or a 10 or something, something absolutely ridiculous. So, yeah, that makes it relatively simple to do. But when it comes to pH in your water with other nutrients, if they're not advertising that, their product has some type of pH balancing technology, then I definitely would recommend doing that. And when it comes to EC, PPM, TDS, that's like saying miles per hour, kilometers per hour, and it's like just different ways of measuring the same thing, the concentration of nutrients in the solution. I do recommend, I think, especially if you're growing the same cultivar over and over, paying attention to your EC, or parts per million, and seeing how the plant responds, like having your own grow journal is like the best way to do that. I would say, starting off with the guideline we were speaking about of just being at like 50% of what the feed chart recommends and working your way up, that's probably the best way to initiate it. But, a lot of times I know people growing amazing medicinal plants at end of flower, it's like 900 parts per million. And then I know people growing amazing plants, and at the end, they're doing 1600 parts per million. And if you flip-flop those nutrient recipes, like you're probably not going to have the same amazing plants that those people were growing. So it's really about a positive feedback loop. And in a way, it almost, it's funny because it's like people should treat themselves the way they treat their plants and vice versa. And what I mean by that is journal for your plants, journal for yourself. If you had a funky day, write about it and try and understand the association between like, you know what, when I hang out with these people, I always seem to have a really good day, and I can look back on that and make those associations. And then you start hanging out with those people again more and more. And it's no different with your plant. It's like, what kind of cool things were going on in its environment when it looked its best? Now, how do I recreate that again? And believe me, if you just try and rely on your mind and be like, oh yeah, I'll remember it, dude, it's all good, I got this, you're gonna realize that you forgot, and then you're gonna like be chasing your tail. So for me, it's like even the smartest people I know are writing down notes and referring back to them, because then you don't have to be keeping like this encyclopedic knowledge in your head about what happened every day. Like, look, what happened in your garden in January 23rd? Do you remember? No?
Nope,
Yeah,
of
I
course
don't
not.
remember. I don't remember. Like, the older I get, the more I realize the value of writing things down and journaling things, and whether that goes to your plants or yourself. So,
I completely agree. Yeah, I have what I use is Google Sheets. And the reason why I use it is because I have a roommate who also helps in the garden as well. And us being able to share that sheet, be able to refer to it and both add in notes is key. And it's basically just pretty simple. On the rows, you've got the date, and then on the columns, you've got the plant. And then, within each cell, you're writing down for that day, like what you're doing, whether it be, you're transplanted on this day, or you fed in, and this was the runoff pH or runoff PPM or pH, even pH going in, pH going out. So just all those details, it's good to look back on, especially if you do pop into a problem. You can look back at those notes and say, oh, okay, maybe this is happening because a week ago or 2 weeks ago I did this. So I totally agree with you on using some sort of journal, diary, whatever you want to call it, to track your plants, because you're not going to be able to remember it. Especially for me, I grow like typically like 6 to 12 plants at a time. There's no way I can remember all that. All different cultivars, they all have different nutrient requirements, so it's super tough. What do you use to track? Do you use any sort of app
You
or
know what's really
just
funny?
piece of paper or what?
Yeah, no, I'm a definitely a child of the internet, so I'm extremely digital. And most of my notes either go into Google Drive shared spreadsheet or Evernote. Those are my two go-tos. So I'm probably very, very similar to you, and it's good doing it with someone too, because they can kind of keep you accountable in a way. They can prod you if you missed a day or two. And also, like, don't sweat it. Like, some people are super perfectionists, and they'll be like, oh, I'm gonna start journaling, every single day of my growing operation, and it's gonna be perfect. I'm gonna write like a paragraph each day, and then I'm also gonna do 100 push-ups and run 3 miles. And dude, like, relax. It's okay. You just put like a couple small notes that takes you 5 seconds. Don't set yourself up to fail. And like if you miss a few days, oh man, I went out with my friends and I had a wicked hangover and I missed a day or something. Like, look, it's okay. You don't need perfection. Just like if you can get it the majority of the time, you're doing yourself like exponentially better than not doing it at all. So it's almost like that one push-up rule kind of thing. Like I have to use it all the time. I think I have to refer back to it like every other week, but it's like, look, every morning, just do one push-up. If you don't want to do a second one, you don't have to. But oftentimes what happens is you like end up doing like 10 or 20 push-ups because you're like, you know what? I'm already down here. I'm already doing the push-up. Why should I get back up? But some days you just do one push-up, you know? And that's just kind of the way it is. Plants are like life, you know? They teach you a lot.
Yeah, that's a really great point for sure.
Yeah.
Let's switch it up. Let's talk about environment a little bit.
Yeah.
So, temperature, humidity, what do you typically aim for on those avenues?
Yeah. It's so funny also because in many ways, people are like, man, your home grow must be so dialed in and perfect. You help build out these like basically multi-million dollar operations with equipment and things like that. And I'm like, well, because I'm doing that, sometimes I don't pay as much attention to the one at home as I should. And I will be the first person to admit that. But a lot of times, like, I don't like it's basically in a room, and whatever that room is what the grow tent is. So the thing is, in the winter, it's probably closer to about a 75. And being in Arizona, humidity is naturally pretty low, so I do have to find cultivars that can deal with that. Usually, I am keeping like in flower. I do try and keep it around like 50% in veg, and then around 40% in flower, which is a little bit lower than probably the average person. But look, I'm in Arizona, right? But when it comes to temperature, around 75 in the winter, it probably gets to 80. Maybe I might even creep up to 85 in the summer. Depending on that room, it's just the natural house is getting a little bit warmer. But especially in the summer, I'm always adding CO2. And people are like, oh, what kind of crazy CO2 operation you got going in there? And I'm like, dude, it's a 4x4 tent. Just get an exhale bag or two, hang it up, you'll be fine, And so that's what I do for that little guy.
That's what I was going to ask if you supplemented CO2. So use the bags. Have you had good success with those? Do you hang them above the plants or what do you do with those?
Definitely hang them above the plants because CO2 will fall. So naturally you do want to hang them out up there. We did do some testing. I'm a very big tester. I love testing products. Like I don't trust most things that are given to me until I can corroborate the evidence myself, especially if it's something that's going to be like, for example, a product we're going to bring to market, right? It's like, you have to make sure you rigorously test the product to make sure that it's good. And I got into that even before, we were coming out with our own products. I was testing a lot of LEDs. These days, I'm sending them to light laboratories and doing full panels on like other brands of LEDs. It costs $1,000 per test. But we do that. We have a blog on our website where we test a lot of that stuff. But I like to find like, here's the marketed efficiency of the LED, and then most often, here is where the actual testing comes into the efficiency of LED in terms of UMOLs per joule. So that efficiency rating that a lot of people see. So there are a lot of LED companies out there. I'm not gonna name any names, but I will say there are a lot of companies, especially on Amazon, who say they're like 2.7, 2.8 UMOLs per joule, and they actually test at like 2.2, which if you think about it, that's like a 30%, decrease from what they're advertising. Like imagine if like, vitamin C advertised to you as like, or a pill like ibuprofen. They're like, oh yeah, it's 200 milligrams. And then you test it and it's like, it's actually more like 140. Like, that's
It's
not,
false advertising, right?
yeah, I guess it is false advertising, but when you're in such a niche little industry, it's like who's the police, of the small industry? I think they're policing more like Google and Apple and Facebook and things like that.
So let's get into the light testing a little bit more. That is something that I had on the list here that we wanted to talk about. So you've done some light testing in the past. I definitely want to dive deeper into that. Integrated sphere is a test that's very common. I'm sure you use that, or you've used that in the past, or have at least had your third party testing or whatever used in the past. Can you talk about light testing in a whole and kind of what your goal there and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so with integrated spheres, they're extremely expensive. If you want to look one up and buy one, more power to you. That means you definitely got some play around money. But we do contract that out. We actually do use, it sounds funny because it's like Light Laboratory. That's actually the name of the company. So it's not just a laboratory that tests lights. But they're out of California. Jason Gee, I think it is, or G. I don't know the best way to pronounce it. He's one of the main guys over there, but he's tested a lot of lights for us. And so we do a full panel. Like we'll do a grid over like a 5x5 at 12, 18, 24, 36 inches. They do full testing, looking at basically PPF and PPFD, U-moles per joule. They do it between 400 and 700 nanometers. And for those of you who don't know, that's just kind of like the photosynthetic range. They also test it from like, I think 380 to 720, so a little bit of a wider range, and give you also the PPF and PPFD for that. They do a full spectral chart, so they show you that awesome little funky wave, and you can see like how many blues are coming out in relative intensity versus the reds and maybe some whites and oranges, yellows, things in between. They also do a chromaticity graph, which is a little bit, maybe a little bit above the average kind of lay person to kind of absorb, but they do that. And a lot of people, I actually, who are customers of ours, especially on the commercial side, when they're like, I'm thinking about this LED or that LED, and I'm gonna be investing $200,000 to $300,000. Which way should I go? I want to be able to speak intelligently about what way I think they should go in, and based off of data, not just necessarily what a sales rep from the company told you, who happens to be, a really good friend or a great, maybe salesperson. So I'd rather have the data kind of do the talking for the product, but sometimes the data is not available. So in a way, I felt like an obligation to start creating that data and making it publicly available. And that's where the light testing kind of came from. And believe me, I've tried to test other products. Like I tried to do a fan test with like inline fans, because people would call us and like everyone buying a fan would be like, "Hey, so what's the quietest 6-inch fan that you have?" And we'd always be like, "Man, I don't know. Like this one's quiet when you put ducting on it and a carbon filter, but is it quiet as the other one?" So I bought this like decibel meter, and I was like, "You know what? We're just gonna test it." So we went up to the office, bought like every fan in the market, started testing it with this decibel meter. I think this is one of those really old videos, like a 6 or 7 year old video on Grower's House. Probably still up there. I got it taken down probably. But we were testing it, and I will say, like, we got some measurements out of that decibel meter, but the thing was also like all over the place. So like that test in particular, I will be like one of the first people to say, like, we got some decibel readings for those fans, but like when I was in that room listening to them, they were all loud. Like, could I perceptibly know the difference? No. So you're like kind of splitting hairs in a way. So like some of my testing goes really well, and some of it's like, I guess you can't fail fast, fail forward, I guess. It's a good philosophy.
Now, for the light testing, you said this information is publicly available. Where would folks go to access this information? And
Yeah.
how many lights does this consist of, all the testing done?
So yeah, how many like lights have I tested in my career? We're probably somewhere between 50 and 100. On the most recent and relevant blog post that we have up that uses the Light Laboratory that I really like using, there's probably 10-ish up there, including like Gavita, Fluence, HLG, Grower's Choice, California Lightworks, and I might be missing one or two, but I know coming up we are going to be testing a few more brands and putting them up there. I know that on deck we have like Lux, Illuminar, some people we do take some recommendations from people. So some people have thrown out LED companies such as the ThinkGrow by Trollmaster, Science, and if there's any other LED companies that are really making waves in the industry, then they're probably worth testing. But if you go to growershouse.com slash blog, that'll take you to our blog, and we have a lot of tests there. But there's one blog in particular. I think if you just Google like best LED grow lights of 2021. And Google were like the first or second thing that comes up. And just look for the one that's by grower's house. And that's kind of the LED test. And yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's great information for the folks to have, you know, especially, you know, as you know, I deal with a lot of home growers are really my audience is what I like to think, you know, not as many on the commercial side of things. I feel like more indoors versus outdoors because that's the way I grow. So I feel like a lot of folks, a majority of them, maybe not everybody, are kind of similar to that. So indoor lighting's huge. It can be expensive and there's definitely a lack of data and misinformation, like you mentioned, with people reporting false numbers and stuff like that. So you doing these tests, having this information publicly available is huge. So thank you for doing that for us. And I'll link Grower's House blog down in the description section. If I can find that specific article, I'll link that in the description section so you guys can get right to it so you can see that information right away. But yeah, great stuff there. Good stuff with the lighting for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, we so even though I'm doing the R&D at home, I do have R&D with some friends at, you know, licensed commercial facilities. And I'm actually also part owner of one in Massachusetts. So we are doing some testing with LEDs over there, different types of automated irrigation. Like, so people are wondering, like, oh, do you just have that little R&D 4x4? Like, no, we test. It depends on the product line, right? So we have a little broader hobbyist product line stuff like plant house tents. That's like one of our tents. So I tested that and that's the tent I'm growing in, but that's obviously not relevant for the commercial grower. Right. So,
yeah, makes sense. So kind of getting into the commercial side of things, you have your own show, Can of Cribs, and you tour dozens and dozens of facilities over the years. You guys have been doing that for, what are you on, your third season?
Yeah, so we're like finishing up our second season. Yeah, so finishing up the second season, and then we're just going to keep going. We have some fun stuff coming out, actually. I'll just say this summer, there's going to be a really funny video that drops that is very unlike what we normally do. So check it out. Yeah, definitely awesome. Subscribe to Growers Network if you are not currently.
So a question I want to ask you is in regards to cultivation facilities and kind of having the home grow in mind, right? Like I mentioned, a lot of my audience is probably home growers. Is there anything you've seen in these commercial facilities that you think can be applied to the home grower that maybe you don't see the home grower traditionally doing?
You know, I would say immediately the answer is absolutely yes. There are a lot of differences between commercial and home kind of growing operations, but even in our last episode, we filmed at Shango in Las Vegas. That was just released. And there's this one section where we talk about propagation. And like, you know, in that propagation section, you know, let me rewind for a quick second. When you go into a flowering room of a commercial cultivation facility, it's like, it's so impressive and large and expansive. And the environment is controlled by these like, you know, 800-pound dehus that hang from the ceiling. And there's 10 of them. And there's 200 lights, and they have this Priva or Argus, you know, environmental controller that also cost $100,000 that's networked into their system and they're monitoring by computers. That's not like your home grow, right? But when you go into like the propagation section, even it's like, you know, they're using little 18 watt clone lights on a little rack with 10 by 20, you know, cloning trays with little Grodan cubes and Clonex, you know. And I said that in the episode, I was like, this is the same exact way that you're probably going to be cloning at home. And this is exactly what they're doing at the commercial facility. But instead of one cloning dome, you know, with a few plants in it, they just end up having about 40 of them, you know, with 50 clones each. And they do that consistently every week. But it's almost like comical that, you know, cloning and propagation is exactly the way it is at home as it is in these commercial facilities. So if you watch like any of those Can of Cribs videos, like in the propagation, you'll watch it and you'll be like, oh yeah, like this is basically what I do at home. Oh, but oh, they taught me that little, you know, maybe that little thing about like, you know, kind of like shaving the outer layer of the plant or something like that. These cool little tips. But, you know, if we go deeper though, some of these commercial operations are trying to keep, the genetics of their plant, you know, as pure as possible. So they're getting into like tissue culture, which is something that not a lot of people do at home. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I think in commercial operations, they're really monitoring the exact same environmental factors. They just have to do it on a bigger scale. So they're checking their pH, they're checking their PPM, they're checking their temps, their humidity. You know, the considerations when you go up to a really large operation are not a change in those levers. It's just a change in what technology is needed for you to monitor those levers at that scale and learning that. So I wouldn't put commercial growing on a pedestal from basic kind of growing understanding and expertise. But I will say I do put it on a pedestal when it comes to how you get the proper technology to all integrate together and almost becoming a general contractor of a commercial garden. Like, that's the people that I see do really well. They really study the manuals on this technology and they really read through that and they try and understand everything about the growing operation. And then they try and be their own contractor and building it out. Those are the people that do well. So if there are any home growers out there who are like, you know what, I love doing this, I want to do this for a living, I want to make a career out of it, I want to move from, you know, let's say you're a bookkeeper now doing accounting and you're like, you know what, but I love the plants, I want to be with them every day. You know, I would say start reading manuals on a lot of the technology, like watch some Canicribs episodes because it'll give you a lot of ideas and you'll hear these brands come up. Like these really sophisticated, you know, elaborate ones. Watch a whole bunch of videos and read some manuals on how they work, and you're basically halfway there.
That's awesome. Yeah. Good stuff there. So you are the owner of Grower's House, one of the largest retailers for equipment. You've got to have some insight on some of these new products that are coming out in the future. So can you tell us? Is there anything you can reveal to us? Is there anything that's coming out that excites you?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, it's funny, the largest retailer in the U.S., it's like, we're not really the largest, but if we're like kind of the largest, like single store kind of e-commerce operation. But there's other bigger companies out there, you know, than us for sure. But when it comes to cool products, you know, what I think a lot of people are going to see are, so people might know of like AC and DC fans. Most fans are AC. By, you know, the way the electrical current goes. But there's these EC fans coming out right now, which basically can operate with digital controls, which can make them work a lot better with controllers. And they operate on way less wattage, way less power. And I don't know if people in the past have been like, man, you know, they buy like a little rheostat or a speed adjuster for their fans, and it kind of works. You know, it goes from like 100 to 50, but it's like not very precise and things like that. And you can't really get from 50 to zero. Like these EC fans will be like, I want it at 37%. Dial it in with an app on your phone, like, you know, and then have it change. Because it's digital, it's like basically the world is your oyster. Like as long as someone builds the technology just to like say, oh yeah, at 847, I want it to go from 37% to 62%. But then an hour later, I want it to drop another 5% because this happens. Like you can do all that stuff. And these fans, I think, will end up being like the same cost as like the AC fans too, which is really cool. So that's going to be coming up on the horizon. I think everyone's going to see a lot more like Wi-Fi kind of based and app-based controllers for home grow tents that are going to be coming way down in cost. I've been like working on a project, helping out some people with some stuff like that, where it's like a controller that, you know, it's kind of modular. You can end up hooking up like basically a, you know, like a soil, a soil moisture probe, and then you can hook it up to your fans, and then you can have like a PPM probe in your reservoir, and, you know, you can hook up a whole bunch of other probes. And it's all based on this little one controller with a touchscreen, and you can also hook it to your router and check it on your phone and your laptop anytime. And that controller will probably be like I'm helping these guys out. If you go to Homegrown Engineering, that's like a little YouTube channel by this guy named Volker. He's an engineer and a German engineer who lives in Australia. Great accent. Love his accent. Just hearing him talk is like put you to sleep or meditate or something. But That's a cool channel, and that product will be like $299 or something. You know, like that's cool. I love seeing little things like that come out. Even on the more sophisticated side, you know, there's a lot of things. The interesting thing that people don't know that much is the commercial growers. There's the high value crops for this industry. Like, there's so much investment in R&D and technology that it's actually like spilling over into other crops because they don't have as much profit to like invest in this. So the high value crops are like driving a lot of technological innovation right now, which is awesome. Because we used to be like, you know, the runt in the corner that no one paid attention to. And now we're like a driving force in thought leadership. But, you know, there's some very cool applications coming out with like crop steering, where it's like, if you're not familiar with the term crop steering, yeah, just please Google it, read it really fast, pause, now play again. But they're taking all these factors, and you can like basically see these really small deviations in a plant's health, and then like bring it right back to where it needs to. So you're not waiting a week to see how something's going, and then it takes another week to respond to it. It's like you're keeping that, like, what we can call homeostasis or equilibrium there, and you're like riding that wave perfectly. So that kind of stuff is pretty cool, I think.
Awesome. So lots of exciting things coming on to the market soon. That's good to hear.
Oh yeah. And I think the cool thing that we're gonna see is like Raspberry Pis and like home growers just making their own stuff. That I'm excited for too, you know. That's gonna be rad.
For sure. So wrapping things up, how can the listeners find you and what do you have upcoming in the future?
Yeah, how can they find me? On, you know, Instagram's really big. I like don't really go on Facebook. So I think I have one. I just don't really do stuff on it that much. But I have an Instagram. It's nate.j.lipton. They can hit me up. That's probably the most popular social media for me in the industry. But yeah, I guess that's kind of mainly it. Check out growersnetwork.org. That they have a forum, like a grow forum. We have like 15,000 growers on there who are talking about all this stuff all day long. So that's a cool thing. And man, I guess that's probably about it.
Well, Nate, thank you so much for coming on to the Garden Talk podcast today. Truly appreciate it. And yeah, hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, it's great. Great spending an hour with you this morning. It's a good way to spend it. So thanks, Chris.
Have a good one. Peace.
Okay, bye.